In March, I spent 2 weeks in Chicago taking classes at my seminary, Meadville Lombard Theological School. Seminary classes are intense. We're in class 8:30 to 5, often through the weekends. We're required to think long and deeply about matters personal, social, and political, and while my classmates are lovely, beautiful people, that much people time is just hard for an introvert like me. So at the end of week one, I was exhausted, and I had to write a paper. It was a short one, just 5 pages, on my definition and sources of hope. I sat in the bedroom of my Airbnb trying to form sentences about something vaguely relating to hope, but I was just so tired. Consulting my phone for nearby coffee shops, I found Jackalope Cafe 0.8 miles away. Perfect. That'll be a nice little walk, and most importantly, they will have coffee. I don't know what I was expecting from Jackalope Cafe, but it definitely wasn't what I found. For the uninitiated, jackalopes are mythical creatures that are supposed to live in the western United States and are basically jackrabbits with antelope horns. So what I found was a little coffee shop decorated almost entirely in jackalopes. Small mounted jackalope heads with small antlers, huge statues of jackalopes with sweeping horns, paintings of jackalopes, realistic jackalopes with fangs, and a skeleton riding a skateboard hanging from the ceiling. I sat in the cutout bathtub seat amongst the zombie pillows and tried to center myself to write this paper, but soon found myself primarily eavesdropping on the patrons of the Jackalope Cafe. There was a group of young people meeting to organize about a recycling effort in their community. There were 2 people supporting one another and talking about their process of coming out as transgender. There was a first date full of awkward silences and giggles. There were 2 folks engaged in Bible study and a man with a briefcase working diligently on a computer. And across the room, a rowdy group of young adults, one of whom was wearing a 20-foot stuffed fuzzy snake like a scarf. When they left, her friend traipsed behind her carrying the tail of the snake like the train of a wedding dress. And then there was me, the exhausted Unitarian Universalist seminarian, crying in the bathtub couch, just trying to write a paper about hope. In that moment, the world just seemed so beautiful and ridiculous. It was hard to even really process. The world is beautiful and terrible, I thought. In spite of everything, we are here, alone and connected, and there is so much that is amazing and joy-filled, and also there is devastation and betrayal and loss, and all of us hold all of that. Even now, as it seems I only read about social and environmental disaster, even here in this weird cafe amongst these strangers, this somehow feels like hope. One of the fun side effects of seminary is thinking, or overthinking, about everything. And it turns out the more you think you know about topics, even topics you thought you had a good understanding about or a firm grasp of, the more you realize you have no idea what's happening. So when I started thinking about hope, I felt I had a fairly clear understanding, but the more I pushed and prodded at my definition, the more I found it to be flimsy and lacking substance. Most of us have heard Emily Dickinson's assertion that hope is a thing with feathers that perches in the soul, but really? In hard times like these, when so many of us are looking for reasons to be hopeful, what I'm looking for is a helpful substantive hope. Maybe less perching and more flying, less feathers and more shoes made for walking. In the book Active Hope, How to Face the Mess We're In Without Going Crazy, Authors Joanna Macy and Chris Johnstone propose that we need active hope. It needs to be a practice through which we participate in bringing about what we hope for. Active hope is something that we do rather than something we have. Because active hope is a process, it doesn't require optimism. Rather, it requires looking clearly at the reality, identifying the direction we hope for things to move, and taking steps to move us in that direction. Macy and Johnstone believe there are three stories, or ways we make sense of our world. These stories act like lenses through which we see our lives and situations, and most importantly, we can choose the stories we want to use. The first story is the most common, and is the story fueled by our current society. This story they call business as usual, and it's based on the assumption that little needs to be changed. This viewpoint centers on economic growth and is the story that is supported by our policymakers and corporate leaders. The second story they call the Great Unraveling. The story of the Great Unraveling draws our attention to the ways business as usual has led us towards catastrophe. This story is also the one we all know, the story of our climate crisis and the collapse of ecological and social systems. For me, and I think many of us, we spend a lot of time and mental energy lamenting and worrying about the story of the Great Unraveling. The third story, though, is the story of acknowledging the ways business as usual is leading us into disaster, while refusing to let the Great Unraveling have the last word. This story they call the Great Turning, and it involves the birth of new and creative responses to all of our social, environmental, and political crises. The Great Turning moves us into committing to the recovery of our world in ways that we may not have even imagined yet. We come to this story through discovering and embodying the gift of active hope. Clearly, this all sounds amazing in theory, but it's hard to imagine what it looks like in practice. How do I really take action in this great turning? What small actions can I take, and would it really even make a difference? Krista Tippett of the On Being radio show and podcast interviewed Joanna Macy several years ago, but replayed the episode recently. In this episode, she asks Ms. Macy how we move to action without being paralyzed by the enormity of grief and feel we feel for ourselves and our world. Perhaps paradoxically, Ms. Macy urges us to take our grief and fear seriously. To be curious about it and willing to sit with it and let it move through us with the understanding that feelings of grief, discomfort, outrage, and fear don't stay unless we refuse to look at them. When we look at our pain for the world, Ms. Macy says, when we take it in our hands, when we can just be with it and keep breathing, then it turns. It turns to reveal its other face, and the other face of our pain for the world is our love for the world, our absolutely inseparable connectedness with all life. Easier said than done, certainly, and yet I believe that we were made for this. I believe this ability to hold both our grief and outrage for the world alongside our love for the world is the only way we have been able to make it this far. We need both sides of this spectrum because we couldn't know the depth of our love without the grief, and we would never be able to withstand the grief without our love. It's okay for our hearts to be broken over the world, Ms. Macy says. What else is a heart for? Sitting in that bathtub couch in Chicago, I did not end with a concise definition of hope. However, I could identify situations in which I felt most hopeful, the times when I was pulled back into connection because of my love for the world, in spite of all that felt hopeless and hard. And really, it wasn't so different than that moment I experienced there with the jackalopes, moved to tears by the beauty and pain and absurdity surrounding me. For me, I decided hope is not about a belief that everything is going to be okay. It's not believing there is a point at which it's all going to work out, or even that there is a future at all. Hope is about being able to be fully in the terrible and still find the elements of the beautiful. Finding the beautiful doesn't mean that anything changes. It just means that it's there and I'm experiencing it. It means that I am fully embodied and present in the all of it, the good, the bad, and the ugly. It's loving the world enough that I can grieve and rage and fear and still see all that I find beautiful. In the podcast, Miss Maisie emphasizes the gifts of just being present. She says, the main thing is that you're showing up, that you're here, and that you're finding ever more capacity to love this world, because it will not be healed without that. That is going to unleash our intelligence and our ingenuity and our solidarity for the healing of the world. She speaks about this further in the book, identifying specifically an empowerment process of 4 steps that can lead us into active hope by reminding us that we are larger, stronger, deeper, and more creative than we have ever been brought up to believe. The first step, gratitude, brings us into a sense of wonder for our world. It reminds us of what we love and the gifts we have received through being present and alive. This gratitude helps facilitate resiliency to face the difficult realities that are also always present. The second step, honoring our pain, allows us to respect, welcome, and value our hurt and anguish, while also revealing our care and compassion for the world. Accessing our compassion shows us our interconnectedness with all of life, such that we can experience our pain without fearing it. Step 3, seeing with new eyes, allows us to see the ways our pain is rooted in belonging and love. Seeing from this new framework opens new resources for us. We draw in new knowledge, ancient spiritual wisdom, and our own imaginations to envision a different future. And finally, the last step, going forth. It helps us to clarify our actions so that we can find the steps to move forward. Working as a child psychologist in Baltimore City challenged my ability to find hope. I spent my days with children and parents living lives I could not imagine, experiencing traumas I could not fathom, existing within a system of oppression that felt crushing, even from the outside. It has been the smallest details of resiliency that have given me hope. The child who wouldn't talk whispered quietly, and I saw the beginning of a sparkle in her eyes. The young man who gave me a concussion when he had a physical outburst in session, he knew everything there was to know about tractors, and talking about tractors lit him up from the inside. These things, by necessity, became so beautiful. From this place of gratitude and presence, I was able to find the resilience in others with greater ease. Did you see the way your daughter smiled just now? There was so much love for you in her eyes. Or, I love the way your eyes light up when you talk about your dog. I can feel how much he means to you. Or, I can't believe you made it here today in the rain with a 3-year-old when you had to take 3 buses to get here. Your dedication to your daughter and your parenting is inspiring. There is possibility and connection and wonder in these statements, and there is resiliency, grace, and hope in this intimacy and knowledge of the details. For me, perhaps, this is the beginning of my active hope. This practice of finding the resilience, noticing the tiny details of beauty and naming them, perhaps this is the beginning of my practice to make hope something that I do. this noticing of what is right, maybe that's where my intention starts. But where can your act of hope begin? Can it begin with gratitude? Which story are you using to see the world? Are you looking only through the lens of business as usual? Can you imagine that there is a great turning happening? There is so much here to break our hearts. Yet just on the other side of that breaking is the equally strong force of love. We are stronger, more powerful, and more creative than we have ever been taught to imagine. So let's let our hearts, so full of love and grief for the world, break open. What else is a heart for?